from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Popular culture, American culture, was different this year. More blurred lines, long-held ideas about identity challenged, about who belongs in what category. You see it in film, Creed, Star Wars, Selma. On TV, Blackish, Transparent. In Harper Lee's changed Atticus Finch in Go Set a Watchman. In Donald Trump holding tight. In Rachel Dolezal crossing over. In Caitlyn Jenner. This hour on point, the malleability of identity in 2015 America, where it came from, and why it's happening now. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Have you seen identity moving, changing, challenged this year in yourself, your family, your community? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Maybe Exhibit A this year, Caitlyn Jenner, used to be Bruce, no more. Here was the interview with Diane Sawyer talking about the transition from male to female.
Yes, for all intents and purposes, I am a woman. People look at me differently. They see you as this macho male, but my heart and my soul and everything that I do in life, it is part of me. That female side is part of me. That's who I am.
The year of identity fluidity, identity flux. We're going to look at it with me. Three observers of American culture and very good ones. Anna Holmes is joining us from New York, editor of Digital Voices for Fusion.net, also a columnist for the New York Times Book Review, founding editor of Jezebel.com. Anna Holmes, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you today.
Hi, Tom.
Also with us from New York, Wesley Morris, critic at large at the New York Times. Old friend Wesley Morris, welcome back to you as well.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm okay. I think I know who I am, and I think I'm okay with it.
And joining, thank God.
Hey, whoo! Maybe the only one. Yeah. And joining me in the studio, well, we'll see, is Alyssa Rosenberg. She's pop culture critic at The Washington Post. It's great to have you back as well, Alyssa. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Wesley, we're reading you. Big essay in the Times Magazine, The Year We Obsessed Over Identity, and you write there, our rigidly enforced gender and racial lines are finally breaking down. There's a sense of fluidity and permissiveness and a smashing of binaries. We're all becoming one another. Well, we are and we're not, you write. What is happening, Wesley?
I don't know. I mean, I think it's – I mean, one of the things that I argue and very much believe is that there's something that happens with prolonged exposure to different people. People who are not necessarily like you, people who raised you, for instance, with women. You know, there are generations of men and women raised by feminists. Integration is sort of either actually on the ground integration or popular culture integration has increased in awareness of people of different races. And I think that in terms of aspiration, I think that it's become more possible to reconsider who you are because there are so many options presented to you of who you can be. And that's just sort of that is a cultural aspiration issue. Then there's the sort of actual biological and personal identity questions that people ask. Transgender life has changed and become much more prominent in American culture and in American society in the last, I would say, 5 or 6 years. I mean, a lot is going on, and it for me, the really compelling frame and as a device, the frame is obviously the election of Barack Obama. I mean, he's not responsible for any of this, but I think that he is definitely a useful frame around which to put a lot of these questions. I think that the thing that got him elected was this belief that we as a country had changed. And one of the things to signal that change would be voting for a black man to run the country.
Anna Holmes, there was a time when I think an awful lot of people saw identity, racial, gender, and much more than that as fixed facts of life, a fixed fact of life. And now maybe it's a journey or an open question. Do you see that same flux, that same freedom that Wesley is pointing to in the culture this year?
I do. I see it more in the culture than I see it in the people who are actually around me, your friends and family. Like I don't think that the people around me are searching or at least vocally kind of searching for
good morning
for
what am I now
yeah but it's absolutely in the culture. I was just telling Wesley that I spent last night up very late watching season 2 of Transparent, and I'd watched season 1 2 days prior, so I basically just binged on Transparent for the past couple of days. I was behind on everyone else, and it's a fantastic show, and it really is about a search for identity, and it's not just the search for identity by the protagonist, Maura, who's played by Jeffrey Tambor, but about his children and the people around him, and there's something even though the family is quite dysfunctional, and they all have their ugly sides. It really is quite inspiring to go on this journey with them, even though they make some really bad twists and turns. So both in the popular culture, but also just in commentary that I'm seeing online and in various media outlets, it does feel like there's a discussion about changing identity that feels very exciting. And one other thing I'd say is that I think that this discussion really kicked off on the internet and then was being reflected or is being reflected in pop culture. I know it's hard to separate the internet from pop culture, and I actually wouldn't want to, but I do feel that I was seeing conversations that are happening on television shows and in films happening online many years ago. So it's almost as if the Hollywood has caught up with the conversations that we've been having.
For years and years we've heard about how race is a construct, even gender is a construct. It's all these are things that we make up, adopt, deploy. This year it was all over the place, though, in this kind of permission in the culture. At least some kind of permission to go and be what you feel. You mentioned Transparent as the Amazon series. And, of course, yeah, it's about the guy transitions to a woman named Maura. He's the father of the family, played by Jeffrey Tambor. And the relationship with the family is at the heart of this. Here's a scene from Transparent where Maura walks into a women's restroom with her daughters, not looking entirely womanly to others in there, as you'll see. Daughters played by Gabby Hoffman and Amy Landecker.
Excuse me, are you a man?
This is the ladies' restroom.
Yeah, we're aware of what it is. Thank you.
Okay,
thank you. We're good.
Sir, can you hear me? Because this is the ladies' restroom, and clearly that is a man.
This is my father, and he's a woman, and he has every right to be in this bathroom.
No, he does not. And you know what? I'm calling security because there are young women in here that you are traumatizing.
Oh, really?
Okay, Alyssa, this is my father, and he's a woman, and he has every right to be in this bathroom. This is new terrain in pop culture to my ear.
Absolutely. And I think what's part of what's interesting and what gets at what Anna is saying is looking at the difference in pop culture sort of at the margins and in the center this year. When I was rereading Wesley's terrific essay this morning about the sort of obsession over identity. And one of the things that struck me about it is that a lot of the shows and movies that he's pointing out are fascinating and important. They're also sort of cult hits. I mean, if you look at Key and Peele, Mr. Robot, Orphan Black, Transparent, the first three are shows that fewer than 2 million people watch. Amazon doesn't release numbers, but I would be willing to place a bet that the audience for Transparent is not huge. And in all of these series, they're very much about sort of the malleability of personal identity. But if you look at what's happening in terms of more mass culture, something like the Fast and Furious franchise, Creed, Ryan Coogler's fantastic extension of the Rocky franchise, or even The Force Awakens, what's malleable is not necessarily personal identity, but what sort of people can be action heroes, can be the star of a boxing movie, can be an avatar of masculinity, or
it's not just three white guys out front in Star Wars anymore.
Exactly. And so it's less about personal malleability and sort of throwing off the shackles of sort of identity than the idea that people can do different things within sort of existing identities. So that's a more conservative position, right? I mean, if the star of a Star Wars movie is a woman, it's still the same basic story about someone being chosen, discovering their potential. Mm-hmm. If a black man is the star of a boxing movie, I mean, not only does that reflect reality in boxing, but it means that, a black man can be extraordinarily talented at violence and also be sympathetic and sensitive and emotional and a romantic lead in that movie, too. And so it's not that people's personal identities are changing in these more mainstream projects, but they're changing our ideas of what those sort of previously static identities mean.
Though there was plenty of personal identity change, Caitlyn Jenner kind of out front as Exhibit A, not only the Rachel Dolezal, of course, she who said, I'm
African-American. I cannot begin to parse her identity.
Well, I mean, but talk about freedom to choose. She was feeling it and she did it. I mean, the sort of normative whiteness that American pop culture has long seen kind of as the baseline in her personal life. She said, no, thank you. That's not me. Her parents pushed back, but she was ready to go. And then, I mean, Wesley, I guess there's maybe a backlash here as well in politics. We've certainly seen people not so fluid necessarily, but sometimes rallying, what looks like rallying around racial identity. Look at some of the Trump rallies can look very much like that.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Donald Trump himself is the product of the very thing that we're talking about in a lot of ways. It's not necessarily racial, but it's definitely a political – his political ideas ideologically are malleable. And he's found a way to become a kind of identity monger, determining who gets to be in the country, who in some ways is American, tapping into a feeling that people have, mostly white people, of a kind of endangerment, a cultural endangerment. And some of that can be looked at as American and some of it can be looked at as white. And one of the fascinating things that's come out of the sort of parallel appearances of Barack Obama and this version of Donald Trump, who really has been with us since Obama's election, I would say, is that they represent this reckoning, especially for white people, about what whiteness is in the context of all this so-called racial diversity. And this is the first time you've heard white people reckon with whiteness in the way that they have, I would say, in the last, especially the last 2 years.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the year we rethought and doubled down on and got fluid with identity in American culture, pop culture in particular, but beyond, from Caitlyn Jenner to Trump to Black Lives Matter, campus uproar, Atticus Finch, for heaven's sakes, people obsessing over identity, loosing the reins of identity. Wesley Morris is with us, critic at large for the New York Times. His essay, The Year We Obsessed Over Identity. Maybe you did too. You can join us. What is going on with our sense of identity this year? Are you in the camp that's cutting loose to decide your own gender identity, your own racial identity, political identity, peeling off, peeling away? What is prompting that freedom now? Or are you doubling down on your old school identity, fighting fluidity? Anna Holmes is with us, founding editor of Jezebel.com, editor at now at the news website Fusion.net. And Alyssa Rosenberg is here, pop culture critic for The Washington Post. Here's the sound of Rachel Dolezal. She gave up her post as president of the NAACP chapter in Spokane, Washington, after she was accused of deceiving people about her race. She said that her background was partly black, but her parents told media she has no black ancestry. Talked here with the Today Show, told Matt Lauer she identifies as black.
And this goes back to a very early age with my self-identification with the black experience as a very young child.
When did it start?
I would say about 5 years old.
You began identifying yourself as African American?
I was drawing self-portraits with the brown crayon instead of the peach crayon.
The brown crayon instead of the peach crayon is just a box of crayons. Choose what you will. It's a box of chocolates. And home, the gender piece, I think all of us are coming around to, people talk about a spectrum that people lie on when it comes to gender, about freedom here to express oneself. On the race front, what did you make of the Rachel Dolezal story and what it tells us about racial lines? Can those really become fluid?
I don't have a good answer for that. I'm not sure. But I was not one of the people who became extremely upset at what Dolezal said or did. Mm-hmm. I found her more of a kind of a curiosity than anything else. It's very hard for me, on the one hand, she did not grow up as a black woman, so I reject her assertion that and I'm actually not sure if she ever said this, that she would know what it's like to be black.
Even though she chose the brown crayon, not the peach one.
Right, right. Because I don't, because a lot of what race is how the dominant culture treats you or you know, mm-hmm. or looks at you. And I don't think that she was seen as a black female mm-hmm. at all growing up. But, you know, I really had a hard time questioning her identification with black culture. I didn't really have a problem with that. It was interesting because, you know, a lot of these things that crop up in the culture or the news, you know, have a lot of backlash, you know, whether it's Donald Trump representing a backlash of white male entitlement. But there was also a backlash against Dolezal, and because I think for some people, especially people actually like myself, a number of people I know who are also biracial, mm-hmm. felt very angry at her because they felt that they were being delegitimized, or their blackness was being delegitimized or mocked by, you know, her charade. I personally, again, didn't feel that way. I didn't feel mm-hmm. I didn't feel threatened. My identity did not feel threatened by her assertion that she is black. I don't think that I would agree that she's black. But, you know, there were some interesting questions that were raised around this having to do with transgender men and women. And people were trying to, you know, kind of make connections between Dolezal being transracial, or at least using mm-hmm. that phrase. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure where I stand on that. I still have to think about it. But it was something that I think engendered a lot of interesting conversation. I'm just not sure that I'm not sure that we figured it out, so to speak.
Wesley, it is possible.
Yeah. I
mean,
you find what possible? Gender fluidity and racial fluidity of equal robustness somehow.
I'm open to the possibility that Rachel Dolezal sincerely believes that she is a black woman in the body of a white woman. Mm-hmm. I am open to having the conversation about what it means for her to feel that way. I agree with Anna that there are certain societal and institutional limitations on what else that means for her as a person who self-identifies black, in that she didn't grow up with the same – she didn't grow up with racism mm-hmm. the way the average black woman under certain circumstances would experience racism. Mm-hmm. I think that there – but at the same time, she isn't oblivious to the plight of black people. She was, after all
– working with the NAACP.
Yeah. She was at the top of the Spokane NAACP chapter. I mean, she demonstrated a commitment to black issues. And so, I mean, it isn't as though she didn't use this identification or this self-identification to make music videos or yeah. – do you know what I mean? It wasn't to like –
she isn't Iggy Azalea.
Right. Or like to like promote a fried chicken line. Do you know something really crazy mm-hmm. that also brushed up against farce or satire? Mm-hmm. There was something sincere and is something sincere in her commitment to her belief in her assertion of transracial.
Also, the black community has a long history of being welcoming of people of all types mm-hmm. and shades.
Mm-hmm. I mean,
you know, people
come
in a lot of different hues and hair colors and hair textures.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, some of these conversations have been going on, for example, on Transparent. They were one of the – I don't want to spoil it for Wesley. I don't think he's seen this particular episode. But there's a discussion in the second season about you know, cis women, you know, female-born women and trans women, and whether or not trans women are women in the same way that cis women are because they grew up being perceived as male. By the society.
So, you know, a different life experience. They've just
sure.
they've come up
mm-hmm.
through a different path. Alyssa, you're
and
listening.
Different privileges.
Sure. Alyssa, you're listening carefully here. What do you see? The same degrees of freedom, gender, race across the board. The same initiating impulses.
I was going to suggest that part of what's interesting about this story is that I think people were freaked out by her because the prospect of someone giving up the privilege of whiteness, I think, is confusing mm-hmm. to a lot of people, mm-hmm. and. I mean, the most influential book I've read in the past couple of years, at least that's changed my thinking the most, has been The History of White People, which is the story about how different ethnic identities were effectively aggregated into this single
yep.
identity,
it's
you know, whiteness. And I think, you know, Dalziel freaked people out because she was shucking off this identity that for centuries in America, people have tried to become a part of.
You can't do that. That's crazy.
But I mean,
but she could. She did.
And part of what I think is interesting about the history of white people and the conversations about whiteness now is what would it be like if that identity disaggregated, if that makes any sense? What, you know, we're in Boston, a city that is full of people who think of themselves as Irish or Italian. What if we went back to those sort of white ethnic identities? I don't know that that would change the conversation about race in America in any way. I mean, certainly, you know, members of white ethnic groups are perfectly capable of being incredibly racist in part as part of that quest to become and sort of maintain whiteness.
We've
noticed. You know, it's an interesting dilemma.
The history of white people. Nell Irwin Painter, a very welcome guest here on this show. I mean, I'm fascinated not only by permeability of lines and people changing definitions of themselves, but identity fluidity within categories. And of course, with the on the race front, you had Black Lives Matter, and maybe as a kind of sad, but before it got sad, maybe heroic, I don't know, demonstration that was Sandra Bland. I mean, here she is in Texas, a black woman driving on her own, come down from Chicago looking for a job, and she's pulled over for not using her lane change signal, and things escalate so fast. Here's a little tape from that. You might have heard it on NPR's Morning Edition today, but you can hear her resisting an old expectation that she will respond to police authority in a certain way. It gets scary in a hurry.
Get out of the car.
Get out of the car now.
Why am I being apprehended? You're trying to give me a ticket.
I said get out of the car.
Why am I being apprehended?
You I'm giving you a lawful order. I'm going to drag you out of here.
So you're threatening to drag me out of my own car?
Get out of the car.
And then you
I will light you up. Get out.
Wow.
Now.
Wow.
Get out of the car.
Really, for a failure to signal. You're doing all of this for
get over there.
Failure to signal. And of course, tragically, she ended up dead in that jail very soon. Suicide. It was the explanation. But I mean, Anna Holmes, I hear right there a kind of in the moment effort to redefine identity or roles right there at the roadside.
I don't know. Well, can you elaborate? Because I'm not sure. I'm not sure if I think she's trying to redefine identity or roles. I think that she's
The policeman has an expectation that she'll respond in a certain way to his authority.
Right. But that's right.
She sees it as abuse and says, "No, that's not who I am. I'm someone else." She says, "You know, look, I have freedoms in this country. I have rights. Don't treat me that way."
It's hard for me to say, you know, if that's a result of the culture changing, because you know, African Americans have been singled out by police for decades, if not centuries, and a lot of them have resisted. Mm-hmm. So I'm hesitant to tie that into the culture. Although I would say, you know, was she aware that she was, or that the whole thing was being recorded? If she was aware of that, perhaps she was, I'm not sure if she was, but.
But not
perhaps
just that. This
then
is in a year after Ferguson. This is a year where we saw protests all over the place saying, treat us right, Black
empowered.
Lives Matter.
Mm-hmm. Sure. She might have felt newly empowered in a way she hadn't before. I don't know if she'd ever had a run-in with police before. But I'm just hesitant to tie it to the culture because I'm, you know, who's to say she wouldn't have done that 8-10 years ago?
I mean, maybe another way to approach this, you know, one of the centerpieces of Ta-Nehisi Coates' Between the World and Me, which won a National Book Award this year, is the story of his friend, Prince Jones, who was killed by a black police officer employed by a majority black county. And I think one of the things that is interesting about that story about, you know, the Freddie Gray trials happening in Baltimore right now is the idea that the office of police officer somehow changes the status of black men and women who inhabit it. And, you know, both Freddie Gray's death and Prince Jones' death are both stories about, you know, black officers sort of assuming a different identity when they join police departments. I mean, I'm not like, as with Anna, I'm not sure I see that a sort of change of roles in Sandra Bland's confrontation with the police, but there is maybe something to be mined about, you know, about the ways in which, you know, a black man or woman in a police department, you know, maybe that is a job that has implications for that person's identity.
I got to say, I don't – nothing definitive in my reading, but I heard in Sandra Bland maybe some echo of the big national conversation going on here may be related, Wesley, to the various sort of handles on identity that people are grabbing or giving up in this year, how fiercely they look at those, how they're – I mean, Black Lives Matter is saying – don't treat me as something disposable or less worthy of life. I've got to think that that echoes, but no particular case, you know, will capture all of this. Let's go to our listeners, Marco in West Palm Beach, Florida. Marco, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. I have a question for your panelists about Caitlyn Jenner, since we're on the subject, because there is one thing that I do find maybe a bit contradictory, and it's not the politics of Caitlyn. I don't think being transgender or gay and being conservative is necessarily contradictory any more than being evangelical or rich and being progressive is contradictory. You're mm-hmm. always going to find people like that. Mm-hmm. Well, the one thing I found very interesting about Caitlyn Jenner was the fact that she doesn't seem to follow the gay rights campaign. She doesn't seem to be for what they're for in their respects, whereas she really wants to be accepted for who she is now. And what I want to ask your panelists is what they really feel about that. Is there a contradiction? Can you be pro accepting transgender, accepting the mindset, accepting the science, accepting all of that, and not being for equal rights for gays, gay marriage, gay adoption, and things of that nature? I think that, more so than the politics, but I think it's that necessarily that I haven't wrapped my mind around.
Let us pick it up. Wesley, what about it? Cross one boundary and there's an expectation that you're ready to cross all, or is it more personal, singular than that?
I would say let's come back to Caitlyn Jenner in 4 years or 5 years and see how she's evolved. I think, you know, when the caller sort of brings up – is his name Marco?
Yes.
The caller? When Marco brings this up, the first thing that I think of, and I've been thinking a lot about this recently, is when O.J. Simpson became a star in America. And there was this expectation at the time that he was going to represent black men and black people and make lives better for black people and convince white people that black men weren't these dangerous specimens of lethality and nationalism. And O.J. Simpson, I mean, in his sort of self-defense, said, I'm American. I'm not a black person.
Yeah.
I'm not a black man,
I'm OJ.
I'm O.J. And that is politically problematic, but it also is powerful at the same time. Because I think what you want when you become recognized for your prowess as an individual person is you want to maintain your individuality and not be a symbol for a larger culture or a larger issue.
Well, I think also, you know, in the case of O.J. and I guess Caitlyn Jenner as well, a lot of this is, you know, I'm going to use that dreaded word privilege, but, you know, O.J.
Yes.
wasn't seen as a black man anymore. I mean, he was, but he was seen as a celebrity. Mm-hmm. I mean, and in the same way that Caitlyn Jenner has a certain privilege as a trans woman that most trans women don't have. My opinion about Caitlyn Jenner is that I don't think she's a particularly thoughtful person right now about this
right.
stuff.
This is why I'm saying come back.
Yeah. So, but perhaps that will change. You know, I think that she has some strange ideas about womanhood in general, or mm-hmm. at least equates womanhood with you know these kind of markers that a lot of women would like to shed. You know, their sexual desirability, the performance of femininity, et cetera.
I mean, there's this whole psychological aspect to Caitlyn Jenner that fascinates me.
Yeah.
Given the universe in which she transitioned, the mm-hmm. sort of the familial universe in which she transitioned,
the Kardashian universe, to be precise, right?
Yes.
Boy, well, it's a big picture. Wesley Morris, please stand by. Anna Holmes, it's so great to have you here. Alyssa Rosenberg, all three. Wesley Morris writing that gender roles are merging, races are being shed in the last 6 years or so, but especially in 2015, he writes, we've been made to see how trans and bi and poly ambi omni we are. He says our reinventions feel gleeful and liberating and tied to an essentially American optimism. This is On Point. We'll be right back. talking this hour about the year we rethought and doubled down and got fluid with identity, from Caitlyn Jenner to Donald Trump to Black Lives Matter, campus uproar, even Atticus Finch kind of redefined in the latest on that front. People obsessing over identity, loosing the reins of identity in many cases, or sometimes rallying more tightly around them. You can join us this hour. What do you think? Is it anything goes now when it comes to picking, choosing identity? Is this getting closer to some more true, free human reality? Does it amaze you, or have you been in this realm, on this track, for a long time already? What's pushing in this direction? Alyssa Rosenberg is with us, pop culture critic for The Washington Post. Anna Holmes is here, editor of Digital Voices at the news website Fusion.net. Wesley Morris is with us, critic at large for The New York Times. Responses online. Davian says, in truth, this issue of identity fluidity is just cultural narcissism taken to an embarrassing extreme. Okay. ARP writes to us, I've learned that I can be any identity I want except for a straight white male. I'm a straight white male. We can be that too. No problem. But the context is changing. The culture is always changing. Caroline in Greenville, South Carolina. Caroline, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Tom.
Hi. What do you see?
Hi. I just wanted to bring up an aspect of identity that I don't think that we've really hit on yet.
Okay.
I think when it comes to identity, there are two different realms that it can exist in. There's the identity that you feel, that we are just now feeling like we can share with the world, like the identity that we've always had. But I feel like also with the talk about identity and how much it's permeated our culture this past year, there's the idea that new identities are beginning to just now form. So there's two different types of identity that I feel like we have to really discuss as well.
Caroline, do you mean identities just now forming? That is, individuals are just realizing or tuning in to their own identity, or they're actually new identities, new ways of self-understanding, if that's, or self-defining that are emerging?
I feel like it's probably the latter, in how new identities are just now being allowed to form, so they're just now coming to the surface. And if we weren't having this discussion and the past year hadn't really existed like this, then they probably wouldn't, or maybe not have formed in the first place.
That is interesting. Let me hold that and we'll go to it. I appreciate your call from South Carolina there. One more, Martin in Arlington, Massachusetts. Martin, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
So, yeah, super interesting topic. I've noticed that you'll pose a question about what's happening with this, and so far we've talked about all these individual cases.
Mm-hmm.
You know, why do individuals do things? I find it much more interesting to kind of look back at the group trends. And when you think about it, what happened in the 60s and the early 70s? We had this incredibly permissive era. You know, whenever social changes happen, they're always driven by demographics of some kind. So we had the 60s begat the me generation. The me generation had children, and they produced the snowflake generation. You know, everyone's special. You can do whatever you want.
Okay.
And what I think we're seeing, I don't mean that pejoratively, but mm-hmm. what I mean to say is that what we're seeing here is the good side of the special snowflake. What I mean by that is that these children, you know, children my kids' age, you know, have been raised thinking you can do whatever you want. You can be whatever you want. It's okay. Everything's great. And you know, they begat changes in the school systems, which basically made bullying go away. And so the kind of, once again, not pejoratively, but literally, you know, the upper middle class liberal, you know, society, which I live in, and if you go to any private school or any, you know, public school that's in that sort of demographic, you will find from middle school to high school incredibly tolerant children because their parents are tolerant of them. Their schools are tolerant of them as individuals. They are tolerant of their classmates to the extreme. And I think what's happening here is you simply have a demographic tectonic shift where these kids are now young adults and they're super accepting. I mean, if you basically say, I'm this and this is what I'm doing, they're like, great.
Yeah, you go. Martin, thank you for that. Anna Holmes, what about it? Do you see this trend as the millennial stamp on our cultural migration?
Well, I think that the demographic that he's describing may have a bit of outsized importance. Like, I actually think it's quite small. I mean, we're talking about upper middle class, highly educated, and he didn't say white, but I'm going to assume he meant white people. That actually is a pretty small portion of the population. So are they more tolerant? Well, perhaps, but I also think that people in that milieu can be some of the most intolerant people I've ever met. So it just depends. But you know, in terms of millennials, I guess so. I mean, you know, the company I work for, you know, we basically are devoted to telling the stories of and to that generation, and I do think that they are absolutely more open and interested in hearing particular stories that weren't being told, let's say, when I was in my 20s. But I don't know that I would say that, you know, broadly that they're more tolerant, or that I would agree with the caller, because I think, again, he's describing a very specific milieu. And I think there's this, again, I'm going to use the word privilege. I don't think that for a lot of young adults and a lot of even older adults in the United States that we can just decide who we want to be and be accepted for. I think that, you know, walking, driving while black, driving while brown, there are a lot of people of, you know, of color and who would disagree with some of the assertions that he's making about you know, people being able to, quote unquote, be themselves and be accepted and tolerated by society.
Alyssa, let me ask you about Caroline, our caller from South Carolina. She's saying maybe when you break down old constructs, you open up new options, that actually new identities emerge that just didn't fit into the, you know, sort of the menu that was once offered. What do you think of that?
I mean, I think it gets back to Anna's great point from earlier about internet culture, right? I think that platforms like Tumblr have been these really interesting grounds of conversation and experimentation where people explore sort of all of the variations of identity. It's been really interesting for me to talk to my trans friends about sort of how they identify within their own communities, what those conversations are like. And so within any identity category that's coming to broad attention, there are always going to be rich internal conversations, divisions, different ways that people see themselves. I mean, I think one of the things that's been really interesting about sort of the rise of trans visibility this year is the extent to which the trans women we see who have become, you know, national and even international stars fit sort of a very narrow slice of the trans population. Mm-hmm. Women like Caitlyn Jenner and Laverne Cox are incredibly hyper-feminine, you know, groomed to the nines, dressed by celebrity stylists. They represent this really extreme and honestly very conventional vision of femininity. I'm not saying that's a bad thing at all, but I do think it's very interesting that the trans folks that American mass culture has embraced are sort of conventionally feminine in a lot of ways. They break one boundary, but then fit neatly into another one. And that gives me some pause about how much this year, which I think is undeniably seminal, how much it actually means for trans women of color who are murdered at appallingly high rates, for, you know, trans young people who are not particularly gender conforming in their transition or their presentation. And so I think it's always interesting to be careful with our optimism at moments like these and to remember that, you know, however self-congratulatory we might feel, there's always a lot of work to be done and discussions to be had.
Wesley, new options here or the same old set of blocks just reconfigured?
I mean, I think it's a combination of both and probably some other things. I think that I try to argue this in the piece that I wrote. For as much as things change, they also really don't. I mean, we're still negotiating, legislating, rezoning, fighting for things that were being fought for in the 20s and the 60s and the early 90s. It's just that there are – the thing that I'm recognizing is that the fixedness of those fights – has broadened in some way, but it's
broadened,
no easier.
Even with the fluidity, somehow those coexist.
Well, I'm sorry, the permeability is broadened. Mm-hmm. They feel more permeable, but at the same time, they also feel more fixed. And I think that the fight that you see happening among the Donald Trump supporters of is a real questioning of what happens to us when things change. I don't think I want things to change. I liked things the way they were before when they were, you know, I mean, I'm paraphrasing, but when they were good for us. Mm. And I think that as things get better, I think that there's a perception, and this is the brilliance and the sort of dark brilliance of Donald Trump, is that he is sort of pitting changes against changes.
Yeah.
And, you know, change for people of color, you know, a sort of welcoming of Muslims into American society in an uncomplicated, unfraught way, normalizing Islam in a way, you know, letting Mexicans into the country to work. It's taking something away from, and not just jobs, but there's a cultural disadvantage that white people, according to this line of political thinking, are at this change persists.
And to get back to the emailer from earlier, that's an interesting email, right? Because I think, you know, to all straight, white, cisgendered mm-hmm. men out there, you're okay. Like nothing is going to – it's easy to say nothing's going to happen to you. Everything's going to be fine. You still have this position of immense cultural privilege, which I think is true. But I think that the sort of value of the stock that is, you know, straight white American men has fallen some, right? I mean, culturally, politically, everything else. And I think that is a real feeling of anxiety that even if I don't necessarily have a lot of pity for someone who feels that kind of, you know, anger and loss, I think that's a force – that's still a force to be reckoned with.
No yep. question about that. I want to go to a few callers here. Sean in Fairfield, Connecticut. Sean, you're on the air.
Hi. I want to say that we've always gotten our identity through our relationships, relationship to community and civic organizations, to church membership, to ethnic identity, to family involvement, and to career. And over the past 20 years, we've seen all of those institutions breaking down. Career and employment has become more fluid. Mm-hmm. Family connections have weakened. Church involvement is way down, and community and civic involvement is way down. And so I believe this has created a stress within us and a vacuum, which I believe is the reason for the recent, we could say, obsession of trying to establish one's identity.
I mean, there's that structure. I agree. A lot of that diminishing. At the same time, part of this is, of course, an attack or a pushback against privilege of any number of kinds, which over time one has to imagine that will emerge. I'm sure both of those things can be true at once. How far does it go? How does it socially? How far does it go individually? That's an interesting question as demographics continue to change. Sean, thanks for that. Paul in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Paul, you're on.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I see this really as an old problem and a new problem, both swirling around sort of a fixed situation. The fixed situation is that we all have a biological reality around race and gender and so forth. And the old problem was that we had a rigid set of social norms which didn't map to a lot of people's biological realities. And so that's outmoded, and it has to be cast out. And it is being cast out, as we've been talking about. But the new problem around all this is that the pendulum swings, it frequently swings the other way, and we end up in a situation where identity becomes menu-driven. I mean, people...
Menu-driven, you're saying? Okay.
Yeah, they can't just pick whatever identity attributes they want and then attach them to themselves, like tattoos or piercings. Because you're at that point, you're just doing the same thing. You're denying your biological reality. You're just doing it in a different way.
Well, Paul, it's interesting. I get it. I mean, whether there's biological reality is as determinative as you suggest there, of course, has been debated hotly on both gender and race fronts. But it's interesting, Wesley. I mean, I've very accepting friends of a certain age looking out on younger people now. And on the one hand, they see the freedom that they're exercising. On the other hand, I've heard some of them say, boy, I don't know, that's kind of a burden to have to go to the menu and decide who you are. There was something sort of fixed and carved in the past that could be imprisoning, but could also be sort of liberating, no decisions to make.
I don't know that it's that conscious. Mm-hmm. I think that there are, I think in certain environments, and I'm not actually, I'm not even comfortable arguing that it's categorical, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't think that there's an entire generation of young people changing who they think they are. But I do think that there is a looseness that I think also is a right of youth in some mm-hmm. ways. Mm-hmm. That you want to figure yourself out. I think that what's different in some ways between maybe when I was in college and people and you know people who are in college now is that there is a much more prominently identifiable culture of change and of like identity change
and also like performing identity
because of
technology, whether mm-hmm. it's you know the things that you post on Facebook or the pictures you post of yourself on mm-hmm. Instagram. I mean, a lot of it is performative, but yeah, I don't see how this is any different than you know when I was young trying to figure out who I was.
It's not new, and yet there's something new. The fixed frame a little less evident this year, Alyssa. Maybe more malleability with us As a fixture.
Sure. I mean, I think that maybe the terms of the debate have changed or the terms of the experiment have changed. I mean, if I'm fascinated by 70s radicalism, and one of the things that you see there is people trying to give up class privilege and their privilege of whiteness and trying to sort of transcend and find new ways of living. And so I think that we have new tools, we have new terms, we don't necessarily have a new debate.
We have a new vigor around the discussion of it in the culture. That's for sure. You all have helped it happen. Alyssa Rosenberg with the Washington Post, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Anna Holmes at Fusion.net. Thank you, Anna.
Thank you, Tom.
And Wesley Morris, New York Times, you got us started. Thanks, Wesley.
Nice to talk to you, Tom.
You too. This is On Point.